Good morning, everybody, and thanks for coming. And we're really excited about today's lineup, and it starts with Bob Iger, Chairman and CEO of the Walt Disney Company. Bob, thank you for being here.
Cool.
We really appreciate it. So next month, you will debut Shanghai Disneyland, a project that is 17 years in the making. Can you tell us more about the park and why you're so excited about getting this done?
Yes, 17 years in the making. Actually, the reason it's 17 years, the first time I set foot on the property in Pudong, just outside of Shanghai, was 17 years ago. So it's a project that's near and dear to my heart. And I brought footage, which I'm going to show you in a minute, but I'm incredibly excited about it for a number of reasons. First of all, I think we built something great, as I'm going to show you. But the opportunity that it represents for the Walt Disney Company, not just for that business unto itself, but for the entire company as it plants a stake deeper into the largest market in the world in terms of people, is extreme. It's just what this can give birth to, I believe, over a long, long period of time could be very significant for the company. So we are opening June 16th, just about a little less than a month from now. It's kind of hard to believe, having been involved so long. And we have, for the last 3 or 4 weeks, been gradually letting people in so that we achieve full operational readiness for opening when we truly open the gates officially. So the people going in are mostly friends and family. But let's run the video. This is taken just a few days ago, and this gives you an idea of what we're talking about. So that stop right there. So basically, that area up above is the park itself, and the building with the red roofs at the bottom, right there, is the Disneyland Hotel. And this is a lake and a park area that we built, which is open to the public without a ticket for now. 400,000 people have visited there in the last couple of weeks, and there's nothing but a path around and some food shops. But to give you an idea, we have over 7 square kilometers of land, so even though we're developing this and this, this pad here, this land here, and land all the way over here is all ours. So we built something, as you'll see, that's pretty big. We can start it again. But we have a lot more opportunity. This is the Disneyland Hotel. It's a luxury hotel, about just over 400 rooms in the lake. And then this is the Toy Story Hotel, which is what we call a value-priced hotel, about double the room, about 800 rooms. And this, if you stop it, this is what we're calling Disney Town. So this is retail, dining, and entertainment. What we're doing, we're basically standing at the foot of the park. I don't know if this is working. It's working, but you can't see it. And this is 2 streets that we built. You can't really tell from this picture, but the architecture is very Chinese. I'm going to talk about the influence of Chinese culture in this park, which is very important to us. But these are 2 streets, retail, dining, and entertainment. And that building, a larger building over to the left, is the Lion King Theater, where we're running Lion King, the Broadway version, every night. Julie Taymor directed, along with a Chinese director. And that's a separate ticket. We can keep going. This is the entrance. And from the very entrance, you'll see how we really approach this from a cultural perspective. We stop for a second. Whoop. So if we went back, there's only one place in the park where English is on top and Mandarin is on the bottom. That's at the opening, Shanghai Disneyland. Right below it is in Mandarin. But the mandate here in terms of what we wanted to build was build something that is authentically Disney but distinctly Chinese. That's really important because we've been asked a number of questions along the way in terms of what are we doing here that's perhaps different than how we've entered other markets? What are we doing here that will make this park successful in China? And one of the critical elements was making it distinctly Chinese, making sure that the people who visit this park feel that it's theirs. And one way to do that, obviously, is with language, but there are many other. This gives you just a sense for what you see when you walk in. And along the lines of authentically Disney, distinctly Chinese, we eliminated Main Street. every park that we built around the world, five locations, including Hong Kong, Paris, and Tokyo, have Main Street, which is Main Street USA, which is modeled loosely after the town that Walt Disney grew up in, Marceline. We eliminated that here, and this is just something we call Mickey Avenue. Mickey Avenue, all the buildings are based on Disney IP, and it's shorter so that you get right into the fun. And then the castle, this is actually significant for two reasons. And I'll stop it here. This castle is the largest castle that we've ever built, and by far, by the way. And it was built not just to be a building for people to look at, but a building for people to experience. So it houses a really big restaurant. There's an attraction in the castle. There's a boutique where girls and boys can get made up and dressed in different Disney costumes. And then there's a gigantic show as well at the foot of the castle. The size, though, was very important because we wanted to make a very loud statement in entering the Chinese market. Another thing that we thought about here is if you're going to build in a new land, if you're going to bring Disney with all of its reputation and from the theme park perspective to a market as big as China, you have to make a loud statement. And that's what we're doing. And we're starting by we started by conceiving of a castle that's the largest that we've ever built because of the statement that that makes. And the rest of the park is a loud statement, too. We also eliminated what's essentially a concrete hub in all of our other parks and built a gigantic park in front of the castle that has water features, et cetera. This is another example of distinctly Chinese. This is essentially a Disney show that will run six times a day at the foot of the castle with Disney characters, but it was all conceived and designed by Chinese artists, and so all the costuming is very distinctly Chinese. Yet we have a Disney parade that is authentically Disney, except for the Mulan float, which is distinctly Chinese. This is also important because this is a big statement as well. On the main hub, or the park that we built in front of the castle, there's a gigantic tea house, Chinese tea house, with multiple rooms, and each room is essentially a room that represents an area of China, not just in terms of art and architecture, but in terms of cuisine. Again, a loud statement right when you come in that this is very much a Chinese park. And there's the castle to give you an idea of the scale. All usable inside. And this is another attraction, a boat ride attraction behind the castle. Disney characters throughout in this particular case. Alice in Wonderland maze. That coaster at the bottom is a Seven Dwarfs Mine coaster. Walt Disney brought Snow White to China, so they know the Seven Dwarfs well. This gives you a sense of pirates. Pirates, instead of making an attraction, we turned into a whole land. One of the things we also did here is we thought hard about what elements of this park would resonate in China. And we knew that Frontierland, which is in a number of our other parks, which is very much an American West-derived land created by Walt Disney for Disneyland, was not going to work. And so we created essentially Pirates Land, which we're calling Pirates Cove. It has a Pirates of the Caribbean attraction, but it also has a stunt show and canoe rides and many, many other features. It is gigantic. That's the Pirates attraction in the back, but this is all part of Pirates Land. I would sing Yo-ho, Yo-ho, but I won't. This is interesting only because I think it gives you a sense for how technology has evolved for us. I think many of you who have been to our parks know that Walt Disney brought auto animatronics to our parks years back, the characters that exist in a lot of our attractions, somewhat rudimentary in nature in some cases. Well, now technology allows us to create things that are very, very lifelike, and so this gives you an idea how that has evolved. Davy Jones in the Pirates attraction. The other thing we did is after buying ILM, when we bought, well, after buying Lucasfilm and getting ILM, we turned to the technology folks and the artists at ILM and created an experience for the inside of Pirates that really gives you a sense that you are not only sailing in a ship above the water, but actually going beneath the water. And the effects are incredible. So this is taken from the vehicle in the Pirates attraction. This is another land, which is Adventure Isle, and that is a huge raft ride with a climbing course around it called the Challenge Trail. I think this is the highest mountain in Shanghai. I know it is. We built it high enough to be significant, but not so high that the equivalent of the Chinese FAA would have forced us to put a red light on the top. That's the Challenge Trail, which is pretty cool, where you basically clip in and walk around the mountain, which I tried in a pair of loafers a few weeks ago, and I don't recommend that. I think this all gives you a sense. We built something with real scale. I mean, everything you're looking at right now is the park. There's the raft ride with the castle looming in the background. This is another thing that I think is a good example of distinctly Chinese. We hired a Chinese director named Li Shanning, who happens to be a general, was a general in the Chinese army as well. And she interpreted Tarzan for us, but with a Chinese acrobatic troupe from Wuhan. So it's the Tarzan show with the Phil Collins Tarzan music from the film, but with Chinese acrobats, all directed by, and all Chinese performers, all directed by a really fine Chinese director. And this is Tomorrowland. That's a Tron roller coaster in the background, or lights, we call them light cycles from the Tron film. Pretty cool. Trying to envision Tomorrowland in today's world was interesting too, because what the vision of tomorrow that we have, there's the actual ride vehicle, where you get on the equivalent of these motorcycles that go 60 miles an hour. I highly recommend it, actually, but not after a big breakfast. That's the castle at night. We have a castle show at night using a lot of technology as well, projecting onto the castle. That gives you an idea of what you can do today with technology. That's the castle. This is part of the show. I think this is the end, right? Anyway, there's a tremendous amount I didn't show you, but this gives you an idea of what we're doing. We've had about 100,000 people cycle through the park and 400,000 people visit that lake, and so far the reaction has been extraordinary, but we'll know for sure in about a month. Right. But we feel really, really good about this, not just what we built and the size and the statement that it makes in China, but as I said earlier, the opportunity that it presents, not just expanding this because of the land that we have available, but also what it will mean for Disney in China. The other thing is this sits, to give you a sense, if you would land in Kennedy Airport and drive to Manhattan, this would be kind of the equivalent of Queens, meaning right between the main airport and downtown. So when you land in the main airport in Shanghai and drive to Puxi, or the other side of the Bund area of Shanghai, you pass Disneyland Shanghai. So it's incredibly well situated. We also have a subway that goes right to our door, which will bring about 20,000 people an hour, literally within walking distance to our front gate. But there are 330 million income qualified, or people who can afford a ticket to our park, that live within a three-hour trip to this park. So the potential market, just in a very proximate area, is gigantic.
How have you brought in any Star Wars or Marvel characters? You know.
Yeah. So when we started designing and building, and we had to really know what we wanted to build. We hadn't bought Lucas yet, so there will be a strong presence of the Star Wars characters. I have a good picture of myself and Darth Vader and some stormtroopers from last week in Tomorrowland. And what we did there and with Marvel is we built these gigantic tents. And inside the tents are character meet and greets, merchandise, and a lot of video. So in the Star Wars case, there's a whole history of Star Wars in a theater, in the tent. And then as we expand, we have opportunities for both Marvel and Star Wars in terms of potential lands and attractions. So the characters will be there. They'll each have their own home. And now when I say tent, it doesn't look like a tent. They're buildings.
Right.
But they're a little more temporary than a typical building. So there'll be good character presence, but no attractions when we open. But clearly, as we think about expansion, we're focused on core franchises and brands like Star Wars and Marvel.
Okay. Let me turn to domestic parks. What changes have you made to the strategy or the asset base to drive margins to this level?
Well, we've done a really good job of growing margins and of increasing return on invested capital in our park segment and across the company, but in our park segment specifically over the last decade, by focusing on really core brands and core character franchises, which have tended to have better results. Cars Land in California Adventure is a great example of that, than if we just brought in more generic intellectual property. Interesting, you saw in just briefly in the Shanghai Disney footage, Frozen characters in the parade. In the last week and a half, I have been to a run-through of a Frozen show that's just going into Disney, California Adventure in California. I've seen a Frozen sing-along. We have a 1,200-seat theater at the park in Shanghai for Frozen, and there's Frozen in the parade and Frozen in the castle show. And I sat on Friday here in New York in a run-through of the Frozen musical that we're starting to develop for Broadway for 2018. I raise that because by focusing on these core brands and core franchises, our numbers are better. And we leverage the success of, in most cases, what started as a successful movie across these businesses in ways that have enabled us to grow the bottom line, grow margins, and grow return on invested capital. We've also managed our costs extremely well in our park segment, which has given us an opportunity to grow margins. But a lot of it starts with building the right things in the right way at the right time. And that's where these brands and these character franchises have so much value.
And going forward domestically, is there any new attractions or gates that you look forward to keep driving that forward?
Yes, we're building two very significant Star Wars lands in Anaheim at Disneyland and in Orlando in our studios park at Disney World. We have an Iron Man attraction that's being built in Hong Kong and opening up next year. We have plans for Marvel that we've not specifically announced, so I don't want to get any more detailed than that. But we've got concepts for really good Marvel presence. I can probably reel off a number of other things, even right down to making sure that the Zootopia characters are in our parks. This is a film that came out in March, and the last I checked, it's done $980 million in global box office. And we've already put the characters at Disneyland. There's a line waiting to meet them, and it also did extraordinarily well in China, so the characters will be in Shanghai Disneyland as soon as possible. These things all help a lot in terms of the margins and the returns on investment in these parks.
Yeah, I was going to mention, we did analysis on return on invested capital over the past decade. Disney's had a tripling of return on invested capital since you've been there. It's near the highest of the peer group, which is impressive given the asset mix that you have. Historically, we thought lower ROIC businesses. So I wonder, how have you accomplished that return on invested capital improvement given the footprint, which is different than some of the peers who are more cable network only?
Well, we looked at it when I came in, and clearly we thought there were opportunities to improve returns. And one of the things that we did, which had been done actually just right before I became CEO, we emphasized it even more when I became CEO, is we tied return on invested capital to compensation. So it became a critical metric in the compensation of of key executives. Actually, it went beyond just key executives. We spread it pretty much throughout the organization, multiple businesses. And we got very specific about it, including with the studio, where the return on invested capital in their films was known. We basically had estimates of what it would be, and we created metrics against it, and we bonused the studio executives. It was kind of unheard of in Hollywood. And that certainly helped because it just created a focus, obviously, and an incentive. The other thing that was very, very clear, which I think goes back to when I came in, is that our returns on invested capital would be better if we focused on core brands and franchises. So when I became CEO, we were making more non-Disney movies than Disney movies. We were making movies under the Buena Vista brand. And if you looked at the returns on those films, they were all probably mid-single digits. And I don't have the specific number in my head in terms of the returns on the Disney-branded films, but I know that they're substantially higher. We then bought Pixar, we bought Marvel, we bought Lucasfilm. We believe that the returns on invested capital in those three movie brands could be much higher than the industry returns, meaning not just the Walt Disney Company, but across the industry. And it's interesting because since we bought Pixar, we've made 28 films under the Disney Animation, because we took the Pixar team, John Lasseter and Ed Catmull, and put them in charge of Disney Animation and asked them to revive it. So Disney Animation, Pixar, Marvel, and Lucas, 28 films, average global box office $780 million on those 28 films. Now, I can tell you, if you look at the return on invested capital on those 28 films, they would make the rest of the industry look silly, like really silly. They're significant. And there's a reason for that. Now, the other thing you have to do is you can't just put a brand on a movie, and you can't just make a movie because the concept is right. You have to execute against it. And while we have not been perfect, we've had misses, and we'll continue to, but we've had fewer misses because we've also had just a tremendous attention to detail when it comes to making these movies good. And I give, you know, John Lasseter and Ed Catmull and Kathy Kennedy and Kevin Feige and Lou Desposito from Marvel and Alan Horn a tremendous amount of credit for the attention that they pay to making these movies stronger. And by the way, it affects their personal bottom line, because if you look at the returns on the movies they're making, they're better and their bonuses are higher.
Yeah, we hear often, you're just getting lucky, but within that answer, you know, there's a method to that.
Well, I don't think 28 films at 780 million average global box is lucky, actually. Now, we're going to have some films that miss at some point. I'm not going to suggest we're unlucky. There's a reason for that happening. You know, usually, if you make a really good film, it's going to do well in today's marketplace. If you make a bad film, it's probably not going to.
You don't know about it,
because you can't hide that anymore.
One of the interesting things that you did is when you bought Pixar, Marvel, and Lucasfilm, you kept them separate. You kept the cultures on their own. Why did you do that? Is that part of the success in not blending them into one big brand?
They were all different, meaning they all had elements that I thought were part of the value proposition, that contributed to the value proposition. In Pixar's case, there was a culture at Pixar that was very distinct and really valuable and important to the people who worked there. And it was really important to all of us, including Steve Jobs at the time who sold us Pixar, that we preserve that culture because we thought it was a major contributor to the creativity, and it also was a major contributor to retention of core talent, and we've retained all the talent there. There wasn't a need for us to impose a Disney culture on them. Now, there was a need for us to create efficiencies when it came to marketing and distribution globally, and efficiencies when it came to consumer products. We've done all that. But we've managed to essentially create efficiencies without destroying culture. Marvel, completely different, but they had a love and an appreciation of their brand that no one at Disney had. And so by just sort of, I don't know, sanitizing them in some way or bringing them into Disney in a way that made them more Disney than Marvel, that over time, that would have had, I thought, a negative impact on their on their films. And Lucasfilm, really completely different, because they didn't have any movies in production when we bought them. But there was obviously a deep knowledge and appreciation for all things Star Wars that would have taken us years at Disney to figure out. So keeping the people that lived and breathed Star Wars was pretty important, if not vital, to getting the first movie made right. And we did.
Right.
You know, feel great about that.
Okay, let me turn to ESPN. Benjamin Graham, who's the father of value investing, many of our clients know who he is, said in the short term, the stock market behaves like a voting machine, but in the long term, it acts like a weighing machine. The market went into a panic last summer when you updated your cable network guidance. And as you've long stressed, you manage a company for the long term, not for quarterly guidance. So what do you think the panic crowd about ESPN is missing when it comes to the long term?
Let's go back to what you just said about, you know, managing for the long term. I hope you all appreciate this, but if you're running a company like this, you can't possibly run it with a great focus on quarterly results. Because if you do, if you're so focused on what I'll call very near term, then your long-term prospects are going to dim appreciably. Because we live in such a dynamic marketplace worldwide, changing constantly. And if you don't have your finger on the pulse of that dynamism or all of that change, and you're not really thinking hard about how this company and its assets will be positioned in so many different ways over the long term, you become completely irrelevant and your business falls apart. And that's for the company overall, but it's also for a lot of our assets. This means specific assets. Now, we obviously are very aware of our quarterly results. We have to announce them quarterly. But we just are not managing the company, meaning we're not making decisions that are tied very specifically to what happens in each quarter. And that can be challenging and frustrating sometimes, too. So, for instance, we don't give guidance. We haven't given guidance. We've given some sub-guidance on some things. You mentioned one, which is, and I'll come back to that. At one point, we talked about ESPN sub-revenue, I believe. We talked about affiliate revenue. And we had a need, because the numbers had changed, we felt we should update what we had said. Eventually, it was going to catch up with us, so we figured, why not deal with it? But again, we're not managing for quarterly results, and we're not giving guidance. And interestingly enough, we had 5 years without guidance and managing for quarterly results where we still delivered results that were better than what the street expected us to be. That's pretty extraordinary. And we felt pretty good about that because we just weren't disappointing. And we had a quarter this past quarter, I know we weren't talking about that, but where we didn't achieve what the street thought we should achieve. Yeah, you know, we don't stop, we don't pause, it doesn't cause us to do anything different. I know there's a big reaction to that or a disappointment or whatever, but it doesn't have any impact on us at all. On ESPN, I've been asked if I had to do it all over again, would I have said the same things back last summer that I said, because it did send ripples through the marketplace. You know, I've tried really hard over these almost 11 years that I've been in this job to be really candid about what I'm seeing in the marketplace to the extent I thought it was relevant and material to in the investment community. And we had seen a trend at ESPN on the sub front that was, I wouldn't call it sobering, but not as robust as I think it had been expected. It was tied to this guidance issue that we had. Maybe it speaks for why guidance can be so bad, by the way, because I think if we hadn't guided in terms of sub-revenue, would we have said that then? Maybe not then, but eventually we would have said something. Anyway, so we erred on the side of giving all of you a sense for what we were seeing. And at that point, what we were seeing was some reduction in subs at ESPN due largely to ESPN's absence from some of the then relatively new lighter cable bundles that were being offered in the marketplace. And the sense that we had was the adoption rate of those was largely for economic reasons, but it had an impact on ESPN. So we set it,
right.
And the rest is, I guess the rest is history. We feel great about ESPN long term for a number of reasons. First of all, and we can talk a lot about the brand, but it is a very strong brand, the strongest that exists in sports. We also know that in today's television or media universe, sports has a huge amount of value. Just look at the amount of money that's being invested in sports throughout media. We also know that live is also very valuable for reasons that I think are pretty obvious. The combination of the ESPN brand, sports, and live, I think, makes that business still very, very attractive to us and, you'd argue, to others. In addition to that, it is a great product for digital platforms and mobile platforms. Whether it's live sports, meaning sporting events, or whether it's sports news, highlights, information, whatever, it's fantastic for that. And it's a very strong demographic. It's a pure demographic for advertisers. So if we look at ESPN long-term, 5 years, 10 years, we feel great about it. Are we seeing or have we seen some disruptive trends in the marketplace? Yes. Actually, though, since we made that statement last summer, we decided that we had three priorities at ESPN. One was keep the brand and the product really strong. Two, make sure that we really win at what we'll call digital, but it's digital mobile. And third is we had to get really much more aggressive at being on new platforms that were offering lighter bundles or on the more legacy platforms that were offering these light bundles. And we've been in discussions, we are in discussions in some cases there, full-fledged negotiations with a number of both existing and new distributors. And I feel very encouraged by those discussions and negotiations in terms of ESPN's inclusion in those light packages. In some cases, Sony would be a good example. They launched Sony View, and initially ESPN was not part of the initial launch. ESPN became part of the initial launch, and they haven't been public with their numbers, so I can't be specific, but what we've been told is that their numbers have, in terms of sub-adoption, have gone up tremendously. I also believe that in today's world, in the United States, you cannot launch a new multi-channel platform or bundle, whether it's, by the way, 30 channels or whether it's 150 channels, you can't do it successfully without ESPN.
Right.
You can do it, but the numbers will be not even close to what they would be with ESPN in.
Okay.
So we feel good. We feel really good about ESPN, even though, as we cited, there have been some near-term challenges.
You mentioned on the second priority mobile, and I think about SportsCenter a lot and how we all get sports information differently. So can you update us on what's the thinking on what do you have to do with the linear news gathering and how that translates to digital and mobile?
First of all, one of the ways you keep ESPN relevant is by making sure that it is accessible and ubiquitous, that it is in places and on platforms that people are going today. So we could have made a choice a while back to turn the dial down or not even pursue a mobile off-channel strategy for ESPN, for SportsCenter in particular. I guarantee if we had done that, that people would have accessed highlights and scores from someone else, from somewhere else. So being relevant, being present, being accessible was really important. When you do that, you're in a way competing with the mothership, which is SportsCenter live on the channel itself. We don't second guess that decision at all, but I know there's been a lot of talk about SportsCenter ratings, et cetera, and so on, when in reality, SportsCenter is probably more popular than it's ever been, but that popularity extends well beyond the channel ESPN. We've actually grown revenue for SportsCenter on the channel, and we've grown revenue nicely for SportsCenter off-channel because of its presence in all these other platforms.
Okay.
And again, if we hadn't done that, if we hadn't put basically SportsCenter in a variety of different places, we weren't going to slow the march of technology down. It's true with a lot of our media businesses. It's going to happen anyway. It was inevitable that these platforms would ultimately emerge and become popular and grow, and we felt we wanted to be part of all of that, even if it meant competing with our basically the core business.
Okay. You've often over the years expressed some frustration around the consumer experience with today's MVP of the world on search, user interface, mobility. I remember you coming to New York once during a NBA playoffs and saying, I couldn't find the game last night on Time Warner Cable. Do you see any signs of improvement on the interface and experience from the
Yeah, I have been, over the years, very frustrated. I found as I've gotten older, I'm somehow or another either getting more neurotic or I don't know. My patience is not what it used to be. It should be the opposite, but I don't know. It hasn't been that way. And I think part of the reason for that is that we're all now getting more and more spoiled with what technology is enabling in terms of access and user friendliness. And, you know, if I typed in IGE in a Google search bar, I'd probably get my last name, my first name, and I guarantee I'd find something nasty that's been written about me recently. But the bottom line is that today, I think the consumer is not going to tolerate any glitches or any difficulty in accessing even what is most popular that they want to find the most. And I think it's incumbent upon the whole industry, meaning the media industry, to make sure that no matter how consumers are trying to access our product, that they can do so as easily or as readily as possible. And the legacy cable box and the cable platform, I don't think was prepared technologically, and I'm not sure it was even prepared culturally to deal with the demands that today's consumer are making in terms of user-friendliness.
Right.
And new platforms coming into the market who didn't have the legacy issues, either culturally or technologically, were offering access that I thought was much more attractive, and I continue to. So I think I don't think it's the only thing that will keep the traditional platforms or the bundle, you know, vital over the long term, but it's an important component.
One of the gaps has been rights, right? So basically, in the beginning, there was a vacuum of rights, and there was a stacking rights available, and programmers took those rights and didn't keep them in the ecosystem. Do you see an evolution in what programmers are doing to add more value back to on the rights side?
Well, I think what you're talking about is that I think there's a feeling that consumers should be able to find all episodes of one program in one place. And so if they're watching Scandal on ABC and they maybe didn't watch all of them for this season or didn't watch any of last season,
right,
they ought to be able to find all of those episodes on some platform that carried ABC, whether it was Comcast or DirecTV or, you know, or another distributor. And I think there's some that's valid that at some point we have to make, just as I talked about making it easier for people to access things, that I think we have to think about the consumer in that regard. And clearly we know that stacking, which can lead to binging, which is definitely more popular today, and I think there's a reason for that too, because I think the consumer feels more in control. I'll decide. It's funny, I talked to someone yesterday, we were talking about Game of Thrones. And I knew the person was an avid Game of Thrones viewer, and I said, have you been watching this season? He said, no, I'm going to wait till the end of the season. I can't wait. I have to watch when it comes out. But he wanted to wait till the end of the season. And I said, why? And he said, he feels like he's in control. If he wants to watch 5 episodes on a Sunday afternoon, he can do that. If he wants to watch the entire season on a weekend, he can do that. Or if he wants to just watch them spread out over a number of days. Interesting, though, there's a change in consumer behavior. So I think we have to be mindful of that as it relates to where all of our shows exist. The problem is that the economics of the business today don't necessarily fully justify doing that, because while you could argue that over the long term, I know I'm a long-term thinker, I don't want to be too hypocritical here, over the long term, keeping the value of a platform, whether it's a multi-channel platform, alive is critical, and keeping all episodes of one series in one place on that platform could be a contributing factor to that. There's also a tremendous amount of relatively near-term, meaning the next few years, value to be mined from selling these episodes to third parties, Hulu, Amazon, Netflix,
right,
a tremendous amount of money. Not just for the original programming that we're selling, but for off-network programming.
Right.
And we've decided that that's pretty good business to be in. We've declared that being in the TV production business, basically creating television intellectual property, can be a really good business in today's world, worldwide. And so we're making more programming. ABC owns 80% of its primetime schedule, as a for instance. We're making a lot more programs beyond just ABC. And mining value near term is a good thing. Whether we'll continue to do that in the same way over the long term, I think it's unclear.
You know, you've said that one of your answers to ESPN, the third thing you've done is embraced you know, new distributors, Sony View. Will we see other virtual MVPDs coming? I mean, we've been waiting for
Hulu's talked about it.
Right.
So they're coming. We were very enthusiastic about that, not just as partner in Hulu, but also as a channel owner and as a program owner.
Right.
They've become a big buyer of our programs already, and them becoming a distributor of our channels we think is great. We've seen the interface because we're partners,
right.
And it's great interface. It's a tremendous user experience, so we're very excited about it. And we're in discussions with them about our channels and about prices, et cetera. But that we think that's a good thing. New entrants into the marketplace we think is great because obviously it's basically more mouths to feed
right.
in terms of buying our programming. But I also think that new entrants will keep the legacy entrants more honest when it comes to not just what they're paying us, but the user interface that
okay.
we talked about.
Okay. So the reason you're here is upfront week. Yesterday, ABC had their upfront. How do you think about the network? There's been some change in leadership, and do you view it as a strategic asset?
We look at the network as a production, more as a production company than as a distribution company, or business, I should say. I mentioned the 80% of the network programming being owned, produced by in-house production units. So as we look at ABC, while the network itself, as a distributor of our programming, has value, particularly because of the advertising revenue it brings in, we look at it in combination with the producing side or the intellectual property side of that business, which is also creating a lot of value for us as a company. Because they're producing not only for those platforms, but they're producing original programming for other platforms and selling the programming they make for all platforms on a worldwide basis. So that's how we look at it. I think if a company is in the business of creating intellectual property, then that is a strategic asset for us.
Okay. You mentioned this before in one of your answers. Can you give us an update on the outlook for consumer products business? And what do you think drives growth into the future? That was a focus from the last call we had, the last earnings call.
Yes, that was actually, we're curious about that too, because there was a big reaction to our consumer products numbers. That was a business that no one had paid any attention to for years. And all of a sudden, it was a big deal. I think the reason for that is because it's a business that threw off about $500 million in operating income to the company not that long ago, and now it's about three times that, and there are estimates that it could be four times that, which I will not either confirm or deny, but it's been a real growth business for us. Now, one of the reasons for that is the acquisitions of Marvel and Lucasfilm helped a lot, but we knew when we valued those businesses that if we continued to create great intellectual property, it would throw off a lot more value to the company and consumer products. And the business that we have with consumer products is unrivaled, really, in the industry. It's just we're the only company in the entertainment space that has a consumer products merchandise business that's that global, that is that large, that is that profitable, that significant. So to your question, I'm not sure, where is it headed?
Right.
Is that it, our belief is that it will continue to be a great business for us. Now, there will always be some cyclicality because Frozen comes out and it's the hottest thing that we've made in a decade,
right.
and it does extremely well in consumer products, and it will continue to sell well, but not necessarily at the rate that it sold when it came out. So it'll be an annuity, but not necessarily at the size.
Right.
But then Star Wars comes out, and that has the same effect, and then we layer Marvel in, but it's not always one on top of the other, growing, growing, growing. Sometimes it's, you know, one comes in and stays high and then goes down, but another one fills in that gap. So I think that's one way of my saying it will continue to be a significant business for us. But growing it at the rate that we've grown it these past 5 to 10 years isn't necessarily going to happen. I'm not suggesting that it won't grow, but we're not going to have 10 more Frozens. We should be so lucky.
Right.
But we'll continue to mine the intellectual property that we own and that we're going to continue to make in a way that is very profitable. And that's a business that has extremely high return on invested capital, obviously, because the license side of it is so attractive.
And then tying it back to your opening video on China, we think about consumer products in China. How big is that opportunity for you?
Consumer products business in China could be big. What we still don't know fully is whether character merchandise, will be as popular long term, meaning will they want to wear T-shirts with Mickey Mouse? Well, you see it wherever you go, but you also see the NBA, Michael Jordan, and which is a pretty good brand. And so, but we don't know whether it will become as popular as it is in other markets like the United States and parts of Europe and Latin America, but it could. Also, the retail market in China, while it is growing, particularly the presence of big box retailers, it's more fragmented than it is here, and that creates certain issues as well. But it definitely is a growth business for us there.
Okay. Bob, thank you for coming over. We're out of time. Thank you so much for coming. I really
appreciate it. Pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.